You're listening to Peel Talks Housing, the Region of Peel's podcast delving deep into complex issues around affordable housing and homelessness and efforts to help residents get and keep housing. Episodes will feature residents with lived experience, Region of Peel staff, our partners, academics, policymakers, and other leading voices in the affordable housing sector. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council.
We acknowledge our presence on the traditional territory of many Indigenous nations, including the Anishinaabe Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and the Huron-Wendat. It is now home to many First Nation, Inuit, and Métis communities. We acknowledge the current treaty holders, the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. The territory is subject of the Dish with One Spoon, Wampum Belt Covenant. Hello, and welcome to Peel Talks Housing. My name is Gabriella Ionello. I'm your host today, filling in for Axa Villamil. Today's topic of discussion is encampments. We're joined today by three amazing guests, Maddie Digman, Jasdeep Najjar, and Dr. Caitlin Schwan. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks so much for being here. Can we start this conversation off by you guys introducing yourselves and telling our listeners a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Maddie Digman. I'm a registered social worker and I work for the Canadian Mental Health Association of Peel Dufferin. I work in the capacity of outreach, so working in the community with folks experiencing homelessness or at imminent risk of homelessness.
I am Jasdeep Najjar. I'm also a registered social worker. Social worker being for the outreach team for Canadian Mental Health Association, Peel Dufferin.
I'm Caitlin Schwan. I'm the director of research at an organization called The Shift. Our mandate is to advance the human right to housing globally. So my goal is really to try to make research meaningful as we're trying to end homelessness, address evictions, kind of really get at those key housing issues that we're experiencing around the world. And using research to do that.
Great. Thanks so much. So my first question for everyone is, what is an encampment and why do we have them?
So an encampment is a temporary or a safe accommodation for clients who are experiencing homelessness. Many of these encampments are found in kind of various parts of the city. They're found in forests, sometimes in parks. I've gone to encampments where they've been at the top of the hill. So they're spread all throughout the city, in Mississauga and in Brampton. And we tend to engage with them in the best way possible.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning as well for some folks who might be unfamiliar with the term encampment. It can look very different for a lot of different folks. Some people, you know, have tents, they have sleeping bags, they have their belongings around. Other locations, you know, can be kind of tucked away. It might just be under a bridge. You'll see a sleeping bag and maybe a suitcase, things like that. Just kind of pieces of evidence that people are residing there.
I would just add, I mean, we've had encampments for decades now, but kind of since COVID has emerged, we've seen a real increase in encampments kind of across the country, but also globally. So I think it's important to understand these are kind of moments where folks are trying to survive in the midst of a housing crisis and a pandemic. And, you know, there's important kind of mutual aid functions that encampments can play in a sense of community. And you know, quite frankly, they can play a very important role in terms of people's well-being and survival in the midst of lacking housing.
So Caitlin, you mentioned COVID-19. So how has the pandemic impacted the prevalence of encampments?
Yeah, what we've seen certainly across the GTA and across Canada is that because most shelters are kind of congregate living, there's a real fear amongst folks experiencing homelessness of contracting the virus and or spreading it. So folks are, you know, quite rationally making the choice that living outdoors is safer, including living in an encampment. So that's been a major factor. The other factor we've seen is there's been a closure of services or a reduction in services, especially at the beginning of the pandemic. And during that time, we saw a major increase in encampments in various cities and communities. communities. And then just more generally, kind of the protocols and regulations in shelters or services has also changed. And for some folks that has really worked, and for other folks it really hasn't. So, in part, at a general level, it's a lack of affordable housing that is putting pressure on the homelessness sector and system. But this is a kind of a critical moment where we're seeing some gaps in how we deliver services around homelessness.
So just to add to Caitlin's point about COVID-19, we've met a lot of individuals in encampments. Their number one reason of not accessing services, not accessing shelters, was because of the virus and contracting the virus. And what's that going to look like for them in terms of their physical health? So there was a lot of fear around that as well. Even though, you know, the shelter systems have tried to do their best to contain the virus, there is a huge element of fear. And I think we've tried to kind of, let individuals know about the procedures, the policies that, you know, the shelters were doing. But sometimes, you know, I think COVID-19 was a scary time, or is still a scary time for many individuals. So that was kind of the piece where, you know, it was hard to engage with them in accessing these services or accessing shelter. Also, many individuals we have met had lost their job due to COVID-19. So the homeless population has increased significantly as well.
Great, thanks. So Jasdeep, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but who exactly lives in these encampments and why would someone choose to live there?
So we've met people from all different walks of life. Just like I said, people have lost their jobs. Also people living with mental health and addiction issues. A lot of individuals who do have mental health issues feel safer more in an encampment than being around or being in a congregate setting. The encampment also provides a sense of, you know, safety. There's a sense of community there as well. So those are kind of the main things of why people live in encampments. There's more sense of freedom, more sense of, you know, just more control of life, and issue and comfort as well.
I think it's really important to note that the who of who lives in encampments is very much, it's very broad. It's not one type of person. It's not one person from a specific demographic or walk of life, that it's many different people from many different scenarios. And I think in the case of encampments as well, it's important to note that there's a lot of folks who they have a sense of community with who they stay with, right? So if it means staying with their partner, with their extended family, with friends, with other folks who are experiencing homelessness who they've known for quite some time, it's a level of safety. It is their home base. And like Jasdeep said, there are people who are experiencing mental health concerns, people who are experiencing addictions, which, you know, is very difficult. Lots of people who are experiencing addictions, if they're in active addiction, they may opt to be around other people who have similar lifestyles. If they are, seeking to get assistance or treatment for their addiction, they might choose to be around people of that lifestyle. And I think that's really important to note too. It's about consistency of, do these people kind of align with the way that I live my life as well, for a lot of those folks. So.
And that's why I had stressed earlier about saying that when you had asked about what is an encampment, I stressed the word safe, because a lot of individuals do feel safe in these encampments.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I mean, I think those are beautiful points. Certainly in the work I do, we've seen a huge diversity of folks who are residing in encampments, for sure. When I've looked at the research on this, what is clear is we're seeing folks who are living in encampments are more likely to kind of be at the intersection of experiences of marginalization or oppression on the basis of race or gender, Indigenous heritage. So, for example, we know Indigenous folks are enormously overrepresented in homeless populations across the country, and they're more likely to be residing outdoors and more likely to be residing in encampments than some other populations. Again, just related to kind of historic and contemporary forms of colonialism and how that plays out in our world. But, you know, it's been interesting. I recently did a study on women's homelessness across the country, and we found that women and gender diverse folks with disabilities are much more likely to struggle to access shelters, to access services. So sometimes when you're seeing folks in encampments, you're seeing folks that, you know, shelters or services are not physically accessible to them. We found that folks with disabilities were barred from shelters or couldn't access shelters at twice the rate. Folks with physical disabilities were unable to access shelters at three times the rate. So there's kind of there's some broader issues here too in terms of inequality and kind of how it plays out. So sometimes I think in many instances, we're seeing folks who are experiencing really deep forms of marginalization that end up living in encampments, as well as folks that, for example, have pets or want to remain with partners and they can't find a shelter that would accommodate themselves and their partners. Yeah, and I mean, just to kind of emphasize Jasdeep's point on the safety issue, like, the work we've done when we've engaged with encampments is like everyone we've spoken to has said, you know, encampments feel a lot safer to me. And there's I think that's really important as we think about kind of solutions to homelessness and imagine where we can go from here after the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree. Safety and community are two very important things. So it's good to hear that people coming to encampments can get those. So Jasdeep and Maddie, can you tell us about your experience as outreach workers interacting with encampments and their residents? So what's important for our listeners to know in the sense of their success and challenges?
I think the success that we've made is coming from a community kind of approach. We've collaborated with the police, with Peel Regional Police, with bylaw officers. Anytime they've identified an encampment, they've alerted us, and we've actually gone together to try to engage clients, to help them, you know, to connect them to services, provide some system navigation help. And I think the collaboration piece is a big one. And also, we actually run a 24/7 street outreach helpline for people in the community who do see an encampment or do see someone who is facing homelessness or struggling. So that's a 24 hours, 7 days a week line that we operate for community members to call if they do see someone who is homeless. And what we could do in that kind of instance is kind of provide them resources, try to provide them access to shelter or any other kind of support that they might need. And I think sometimes... the challenges could be is sometimes engaging clients. There's sometimes been a loss of mistrust as well. So I think it's important. We've gone, you know, 3-4 times back to the same encampment to try to kind of build rapport, build trust with the client, because a lot of the clients have had a hard time navigating the systems. It's become, you know, very overwhelming for them. So trying to re-engage them is probably been one of the challenges that we've faced. But I think we're working towards on, you know, how we can foster that relationship. And eventually, you know, clients, you know, have been able to then access services that they need. But going back to the success, I think, you know, we work as an outreach team. It's a multidisciplinary team. So we have nurses, we have social workers, outreach workers, we have landlord engagement specialists as well. And what I've noticed a lot working with the homeless population is that there's a lot of kind of physical health needs that haven't been addressed because they haven't had access to a doctor. They haven't had access to a nurse, right? So it's really about addressing those health inequalities and inequities that exist. So trying to provide them nursing care to enhance their quality of life and help them reach whatever recovery goals that they intend to reach.
And building from Jasdeep's point, I think the way that we kind of structure our work, especially in outreach, is it's a community collaboration. So we're looking for support from different agencies, and we do work alongside some really great agencies that help us to provide this level of care. And quite frankly, when we work in outreach, we're able to meet the clients where they're at, which I think is a really big important piece. The clients don't have to seek us out, come for us, we can come to them. So that's been a really good success, I believe, of just being able to engage with people. As Jasdeep was saying, you know, sometimes we go there a couple times before clients feel comfortable talking to us. And again, that can be one of the challenges. That being said, there are some pieces that we always think it's important to note. So with these folks who do live in encampments, that is their home. They firmly believe that is their home and that's how they choose to live. So just being very respectful of that. A lot of folks will come across encampments, won't really know what they're looking at. But just to keep in mind that, you know, you wouldn't walk right into someone else's home. So definitely don't do that to them either. But yeah, a lot of the successes for us has been just working in partnerships with a lot of agencies. So we do have addictions workers. We have workers who are specifically focused to housing. So being able to draw on the strengths of different agencies has really helped us to be able to help clients to, you know, meet their goals, whatever those goals may be, and, you know, remaining client-centered and letting them decide what they'd like to do.
Great. And how does this interact with a rights-based approach to encampments?
So myself and the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing actually developed a protocol that kind of outlines governments' responsibilities under human rights law to folks who are residing in encampments. So I would encourage folks to check that out. If you go to maketheshift.org, you can find our resources there. And anyway, part of the reason that we developed that is because we wanted to help governments and other actors who are involved understand that encampments are instances at a fundamental level of policy failure and a failure on the parts of government to actually enact, protect the human rights of folks who are living without housing. So I guess foundationally, the orientation through a human rights approach to folks who are living in encampments is that you're engaging them as rights holders, so not as kind of beneficiaries of charity or not as folks who are criminals or folks who are taking up public space or trespassing or any of those instances. Human rights law says very clearly, folks experiencing homelessness are experiencing a human rights violation, and governments have an immediate responsibility to remedy that. And at the core of that is a respect for kind of the dignity of all human beings, irregardless of their housing status. Just to say very briefly, there's a few key elements of a rights-based approach to encampments. The first is to understand, I mean, as Maddie said, like folks who are living in encampments are experts in their own lives. So engaging them in a really meaningful way where they have control and power over the options available to them, where they have enough information about the options available to them, whether that's housing or services. But then also working, like governments need to be working collaboratively with encampments to ensure that folks get access to immediate adequate housing. So the second big piece under international human rights law is that governments can't forcibly evict encampments without providing access to adequate housing, without providing legal representation, and without asking people where they want to go and what they want to do, what works for them. And unfortunately, we've seen many forced evictions in encampments across Canada and around the world, certainly during the pandemic. But human rights law is very clear that this is a human rights violation. And a couple of years ago, in 2019, Canada did a really cool thing. We adopted in federal legislation the National Housing Strategy Act, which declares that housing is a human right. And so I think we're at an important moment of trying to understand what that means for encampments and helping municipalities adopt a more rights-based approach.
I think, Caitlin, really, you've thoroughly explained exactly basically what I was going to say as well. But yeah, really just clients are the expert in their own lives. And that's probably one of the biggest things that I emphasize in my work and that we emphasize as a whole is that they're going to know best what they need. Sometimes they might need a little bit of coaching and assistance in, you know, deciding what that is. But ultimately, it is their choice. It is their decision. So being able to support that in any way that we can is how we're able to assist.
Great. So to kind of keep the conversation about a rights-based approach to encampments going, what does this really mean and look like for you, Caitlin, as a policy thinker?
As I mentioned, it's a human rights approach really does kind of shift our mindset from seeing homelessness as a personal failure to seeing it as a policy failure and a human rights issue. So, I mean, something I often think about when we think about government responses to encampments or homelessness is, are we actually dealing with the issue or are we dealing with the visibility of the issue? I think what the benefit in the increase in encampments across Canada is that it has, to some extent, forced a conversation around what do we believe all humans in this country deserve just by virtue of being a human being. And under human rights law, folks deserve access to adequate housing. They deserve access to basic necessities. So in our national protocol, for example, we outlined that all municipal governments have a responsibility to ensure that there's access to water, there's access to hygiene facilities, there's access to sanitation at encampments, access to safe spaces for warmth and heat. And in most cases, unfortunately, we haven't seen governments follow that human rights standard, but it is very concrete combined with this prohibition on forced evictions and a focus on adequate housing. So certainly a human rights approach requires that government invest to the maximum available resources in the creation of adequate housing and to engage in a meaningful way with folks to ensure that they're able to access that adequate housing, that it meets their needs, and that it's in their own community. That's also a component of the human rights approach, is that folks deserved and have the right to stay in within their communities. So all, I mean, at a very high level, it is, I think, an interesting moment we're in Canada, where we're really being tested about how serious we are about respecting the human rights of folks who don't have housing, and thinking about, you know, we have a national housing strategy now. We're 3 years into 10 years. There's been a commitment from the federal government to end chronic homelessness. Are we actually going to see that on the ground? And it will really require partnering deeply and meaningfully with people who are having this experience and their advocates and allies so that folks are able to really experience their right to housing.
Great. Thank you. And same question to the both of you as well.
I think for us and for myself, I think it's basically, you know, having the client or having the individual choose what resources that they want to utilize, what resources that they don't want to utilize, and giving them kind of the freedom to choose what is best for them. I think another way that us social workers are trying to, you know, encourage this right-based approach is also advocating for clients. I mean, we know that there is a housing crisis right now. We know that there's, you know, lack of affordable housing. So how can, you know, us social workers, us outreach workers kind of work towards filling that gap? How are we going to get there? How are we going to get them the most appropriate housing? We also work from a housing first model. You know, Maslow's, when you look at Maslow's hierarchy of need, that's like the first thing is housing. So how are we going to reach that? You know, there's also been a lot of clients that we've met who are just not ready to take that step, to not ready to get housing because of, you know, the mental health issues that they're experiencing or the addiction issues. So working with them on kind of where they're at before we kind of, you know, jump to housing immediately, right? So it's really kind of leveling with the client, doing an assessment, you know, seeing where they're at, you know, navigating the system with them, and then, you know, providing the solutions that are best for them.
Yeah, I would agree with Jasdeep in saying that for a lot of folks, when we are working with them in encampments, a lot of our role is just explaining to them what resources they have, what options can they choose, what is out there to support them. There is a lot of misinformation sometimes about what people can and can't access, or they're not too sure, they have a service in mind, but they don't know how to get involved. So being able to be that contact point and saying, okay, you know, we can offer these sorts of supports, which ones are you interested in, can really allow them to be self-determined and being the one kind of in the driver's seat, for lack of better words, when it comes to deciding what they'd like. And again, ultimately respecting their choice. If they do choose to reside and remain in the encampment, that is their choice, and they do have the right to make that choice. And also being able to see, how can we support them? Is it being able to tell them, okay, you know, there are these resources in the community where you can get showers, where you can get hot meals, where you can go in the warm, like warming centers when it's in the winter. Being able to make sure that they know the services that are available to them, I think, can be the biggest first step in order to making those connections, especially within the community. Because like we talked about, it is really about a community approach to how do we address this? Can we, you know, build from other people's strengths in order to support these folks?
Great. Thanks so much. That was really great information. That wraps up this episode of Peel Talks Housing. Thank you so much to Maddie Digman, Jasdeep Najjar, and Dr. Caitlin Schwan for joining us today. You can find information about our podcast at peelregion.ca, and you can join the conversation on the Region of Peel's social media accounts. This is Peel Talks Housing, and I'm Gabriella Iannello.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council.